You're listening to Kauai Community Radio, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K284 AL Haleiwa. It's time for In the Garden on the Farm.
Aloha and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We are your hosts, Robin and Paul, and on today's show, we will infuse ourselves in tea from the Hawaiian nettles tree, overcome pests in our onion patch, and demystify pH and its effect on plant nutrient availability. But first, we would like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, Kauai Marine and Mower, 808 Equipment Rental, and Aya's Garden.
Aloha, Robin.
Aloha, Paul.
Just brilliant being back in the garden with you on the farm.
Indeed it is.
Love standing in the mucky soil, the springtime, wintertime, springtime soil here in the Hawaiian Islands. A challenging time to grow, but sure can turn off that irrigation from time to time.
No doubt. Haven't needed that for a while.
So it's good to be with you all. Thank you for tuning in. And we are going to jump right into our celestial session as we look to the heavens above for inspiration and guidance on planting and harvesting and all manners of work in our garden. We're going to look at the Hawaiian moon. Today, the Hawaiian moon calendar is brought once again to us by the Hanalei Watershed Hui. And today's Hawaiian moon is Ole Kukahi. Ole Kukahi rises on Kauai at 11:01 p.m. tonight. She'll reach her transit, or highest point in the sky, at 4:58 a.m. tomorrow morning, and she'll set at 10:40 a.m. That's Thursday. 69% of the moon's beautiful face is illuminated. And the last quarter moon is coming up on Saturday at 7:16 a.m. The mana'o for this moon is Ole Kukahi is the first of three Ole moons in the emi, or waning portion of the moon's cycle, and that's compared with four Ole moons in Ho'onui, or the waxing portion. And the planting recommendation is it's an unproductive day not to plant. It's a good preparation day, and one of the things I've noticed in terms of preparation is taking care of my hand tools, especially in this. It's more likely, it seems, at this time of year for tools to go away wet and muddy into the truck at the end of the day. And so things are getting a bit rusty. Those pruners are getting sort of not as easy to use. And it's really time to clean them, to oil my tools. And when we have an Ole moon, it's sort of nature's invitation to take care of business like that.
Yeah, it's super brilliant that the Hawaiians had a specific time allotted for such activities. I'm so grateful for that. Well, in the biodynamic look at things, today the moon is in Virgo, which is an earth sign, making it a good time to work with our root plants. Particularly if you don't want to necessarily follow, if you're pretty anxious to plant, today would be a great time to plant beets, radishes, and carrots, kind of our late crops of those. Tomorrow and Friday, the moon will be in Libra, an air sign, making it a great time for our flowering plants so we can get some of our early marigolds and zinnias in the garden. Also, bulbs that are available, such as dahlias and amaryllis, would be a great thing to be planting on those couple of days. Saturday and Sunday, the moon will move into Scorpio, a water sign, making it a great time to work with our leaf plants, so we have time to plant probably one more round of butterhead lettuces and some of those cool season lettuces, but also bok choys, kales, and Swiss chards are great things to be thinking about right now. And on Monday and Tuesday next, the moon will be in Sagittarius, a fire sign, making it a good time to work with our fruiting plants. And ideas for planting there would be peas, some early beans, and potentially lilikoi vines.
Mm. Oh, yeah, I know we got those in a little while ago, but they were sitting in the nursery waiting. So maybe you all have plants that are waiting in the nursery and you can take some of those biodynamic recommendations to heart. So, Robin, we've been focusing on the onions, and you've just mentioned the bulbing flowers, and I was wondering if you could let me know a little more about them, because it's something I haven't delved into, is planting some of those bulbing flowers at this time of year.
Sure. Well, amaryllis especially is just such a well-loved flower around the world and really only thrives well in tropical areas. They're available now at some of the bigger box stores. They have their yearly bulbs that they send out into the island, and there's certainly some really beautiful varieties. Also, dahlias are available here on Kauai, although there are plenty of websites, too, where you can, you know, really pick and choose from some pretty beautiful varieties, and dahlias are one of my favorites. That's actually a food plant.
Really?
The tubers are edible, and they're used in South America as a food with the added bonus of these beautiful flowers.
They're gorgeous, incredible. And that's one that really requires staking, it seems, from what I've seen.
They can get absolutely enormous.
Yeah.
And this is just a great time. If you had dahlias in the ground last year, it really is a wise measure to dig them up in the fall and keep them dry, is basically when they're in their dormant period, you want to keep the bulbs dry. If they stay in the ground and we have lots of rain, like has been happening for us, you can lose your tubers to rot. So if you had some that you dug out in the fall and they're sitting, you know, in a dry box in the dark somewhere, this might be a great time to bust them out and put them in the ground. And with all flowers, a little spot of bone meal of some kind, whether it's fish bone or other bone meal, can just really inspire both the tuber growth and the flowering potential for those flowers. And get those dahlias in the ground, you'll be cutting pretty flowers by May.
For sure. And I want to give a tip of the hat to Kathy over at the Kalihiwai Community Garden, who acquired many dahlias, shared them with many of the community gardeners, and has grown just some beautiful ones and gifts them to me from time to time when I'm lucky enough to be there at the same time in the garden. So thanks, Kathy.
Sure. The generosity of the plants, who just increase their tubers every growing season, is often mirrored by their people, who then love to share them out.
Oh, yeah.
It's a nice little system that happens there.
Well, thanks for that, Robin. There is a notable news item that I'd really like to share on the program today. And the title of it is The Importance of Soil Carbon Conservation in Mitigating Global Climate Change. This story from PHYS.org, a study published recently in the journal Carbon Management, draws attention to the extent to which changing the way land is used contributes to rising atmospheric CO2. Carbon emissions resulting from changes in land use and land cover are the second largest source of human-caused carbon emissions to the atmosphere after emissions from fossil fuel combustion, says the report. In some cases, for example, up to 50% of soil organic carbon is lost when native vegetation is converted to cropland. So the solution is not always more agriculture, but it's thinking about where we should be doing our agriculture. It turns out that more carbon is stored in soils than in plants worldwide, which, if you think about it, isn't that surprising given the fact that the carbon in the soil is the result of millennia and millennia of plants that were alive at any given time having been deposited and stored in the soil. So that kind of makes a lot of sense.
And that's leaf litter and things like that, correct?
Trunks as it of decomposes. Trees and, yeah, all of the bodies of the plants having been partially decomposed, but then that stable carbon being stored in the soil. And it turns out as well that most soil organic carbon is stored at northern latitudes, with a significant quantity locked up in permafrost regions. And of course, as the temperature rises, that permafrost is melting and that carbon is coming under some possibility of being released as well. Then we're able to farm probably more and more north, and we have the potential to lose our carbon in the soil that way. The researchers advise us to conserve soils in temperate regions and plants in tropical regions as we I know I learned way back in school that in a true tropical area, the soil itself is very poor and all of the nutrients are really held in the existing plant layer. So here in Hawaii, it seems that if we can restore forests, maybe food forests as an example, then we're going to be doing our best to really keeping carbon in, locked in, out of the atmosphere, and contributing to ameliorating the effects of climate change.
Is this what we mean when we say sequestering carbon?
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yes.
Excellent.
Yeah. So good to know that. And we have as well a focus today on a wonderful medicinal plant that I know Robin and I are both very keen on, and we have a relationship, we have a collaboration on even, I would say, over the years. And so we're going to open up the medicine chest right now on In the Garden on the Farm. This is Paul and Robin, and we're jumping into the medicine chest today to discover the beautiful Hawaiian nettles tree. And the Hawaiian name is Mamaki.
Well-loved by all.
I'd love to hear some of your admiration for this plant before I jump into some of the details.
Well, my experience with this plant has mostly been in the forest, where you come across these lovely shrubs with beautiful red venation in the leaves. They're so striking. They're so beautiful in and of themselves, apart from the medicine that they do hold for us. And so for me, mamaki means nature. And I know mamaki is also a cultivated plant as well, but certainly when I'm near the mamaki, I'm deep in the forest in my mind.
Yes.
And it kind of just takes me there.
Yes, indeed. This is a plant that prefers riverine habitats, moist forests. It is a subcanopy tree. And I believe that, Robin, I'm going to guess to say that we both encountered this plant first on the Nepali coast when we arrived to Kauai. And this is a plant that anybody who's walked the Kalalau Trail, your face has probably been caressed by the leaves of this tree without you even knowing it as you walk down the trail. And this plant is, from a botanical standpoint, is known as Pipturus. That's the genus name. And then there are a number of different species. In fact, there are only four. I was actually surprised to do the research and find that there's only four species in Hawaii. And pretty cool, two of them are endemic to Kauai, and that would be Kauaiensis and Ruber, meaning red, and Kauaiensis meaning of Kauai. And then we also have Albidus here. So there are three that are native to Kauai, but Albidus is found on all of the main Hawaiian islands. And not one that we see too often. It seems the Ruber and the Kauaiensis are much more common, at least in the lowlands. Maybe folks who spend time up in the Alakai swamp may see Albidus more often than we see on the Nepali coast or some of the other river habitats. We regularly encounter it in Makaleha Valley on the east side. And in fact, that's the only place I saw a single Pipturus albidus, and I knew that I was looking at quite a different plant than the mamaki I've seen in other areas. Other Pipturus species are found in the Philippines, other parts of Polynesia, Micronesia, and Papua New Guinea, and they are also regarded as valuable medicinal plants there as well. It is the native nettles. There are other members of the nettles family, and it turns out that there actually is one that does have stinging hairs in Hawaii.
Oh.
And I can't tell you, I don't have the detail there, but I did read about it a few weeks ago. It's not here on Kauai. However, most of the members do not have stinging hairs. Stinging nettles is actually a popular tea from the United States, and yet people have to deal with the stinging part in collecting it. It actually has a really powerful property in terms of the quality if you intentionally sting yourself with the nettles. But this one, we don't really have to worry about that challenge. Mamaki is high in magnesium, potassium, calcium, iron, and zinc, and it has a number of reported medicinal uses, and this thanks to David Bruce Leonard's Medicine at Your Feet book, one of the great reference books that we like to keep handy in our library. And in that book, reported uses are for high blood pressure, high cholesterol, liver problems, colic and thrush in children, also effective for bladder problems and fatigue. It is considered a general tonic, and it is also delicious. So this is a medicinal plant that is one that you would just consume because it's refreshing. It, of course, is going to connect you with the spirit of the forest when you drink it. And it's just, it's great as a hot tea. It's great as an iced tea with honey, without honey. It's just really so delicious. And actually, there are some companies that package it up and sell it in Hawaii.
I just meant to ask you about that. And from Oahu, I've bought leaves for tea.
Yes.
At the drugstore.
Yeah, I find them there as well. And of course, the convenience that is there, but when you've collected mamaki and you see what you get for how much you pay for, it's like, wow, that's going to get me to walk out into the forest and get my own. So just a great opportunity to go connect with the spirits of the forest, give thanks, introduce yourself to the tree, ask permission before you collect, and leave an offering perhaps. And with that experience, I think that you'll really feel encouraged and confident to be able to prepare this tea. And then if you're lucky enough, perhaps you'll get an opportunity to grow one of these plants. And this is an area where Robin and I have collaborated previously, and I'm so grateful that you have offered that to us so that we could replicate this plant. It's a bit of a challenging one, and I could go on about the challenges I've had, but what was your experience growing it?
Sure. I had no problems germinating the seeds for the most part, and even growing them up in a nursery. But where I live, it's a bit windy and dry for the mamaki's taste, and I was unable to bring a plant to maturity in my system.
Right. So again, yes, this is a plant that doesn't have a very high, wide range of tolerance for your particular microclimate. It doesn't want to be in the heavy wind, and it doesn't want to get dried out. They do actually, it's misleading when you see them in the forest. You may think that it requires partial sun because it is a subcanopy tree, but if it is a sheltered location with ample moisture, they love the full sun and they'll get huge. And it makes a very fine landscaping plant and contribution to a native garden that also has this great utility as a tea plant. The seeds are very small, and when those seedlings emerge, they're so tiny, you can't believe how tiny they are. And it seems like they stay tiny for a long time. And they will, because as with many plants that are propagated from small seeds, it's very easy to get a dense, tiny little stand of these plants. And the tendency that I would have under that circumstance is, well, I'm going to separate them all out and pot them up separately. And that can be a challenge with mamaki because it has a very, very fine root system, almost impossibly fine if you actually unearth them. And it's very easy to damage those roots. And so I have found it more easy, instead of trying to separate them, is just to thin them down to eventually the strongest plant. I find too that they come up readily as a nursery weed. So if you have a tree in your nursery area, that you'll find these mamaki starts and coming up in all manners of pots in your nursery. And then if you get a big enough one, then you actually can transplant it into its own pot, or maybe decide that the mamaki is more valuable than the plant that you intended to grow in that pot
in the first place.
Indeed. But they do grow rapidly once they get up to a certain size. And mamaki, just to round it out, I would say that it is a tea that takes a bit longer to steep. This is not the kind of tea that, like black tea, where the moment that you put the tea leaves into the boiled water, that you suddenly see a color change and you know that the power of that tea has been transferred into the water. this is one that I find, and the technique I like to use is to get a couple of quarts of water boiling, or a couple of quarts of water in a cast iron pot or a heavy pot, and then actually put the leaves in, and it can be either fresh or dried leaves. Put them in the pot while the pot is still at room temperature, then bring it to a boil. And as soon as it reaches a boil, put a lid on and then turn it off and then let it steep for 15, 20, even 30 minutes. And it takes a bit of time, but you'll definitely see the color change, a beautiful copper color. And then once you decant that tea, don't throw the tea leaves away. Do a second steep. Next time, and you can stick it in the fridge if you've already made a quantity of tea. But then the second time you steep it, then it will be even darker and richer than the first time, potentially.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, so this is a wonderful tea, Mamaki. It's a general tonic. It's really going to contribute to our emotional well-being, as well as potentially serve us in other physiological ways. So it's a true Hawaii original, and I hope that you'll have an opportunity to drink it sometime soon.
Sure. I have one question for you, Paul. When I've harvested some fresh leaves and tried to dry them out on a screen, they quickly turn black, the same way that basil leaves do if I leave them out.
Yes.
Have you found a way to get around this for dry, if you're going to pick a quantity and keep some dried nearby?
I find a dehydrator is essential. So I find that even if you put the fresh mamaki leaves in a pile, like when you collect them, you get this pile, like a pile of cards or a stack of cards. Even if you put it in the fridge, you'll get that blackening in a couple of days. And so the best thing to do is the very day that you harvest, I like to wash them first and then put them into a salad spinner to get them the first level of dry. And then I will lay them out on a dehydrator and dehydrate them at about 125 degrees, I think was the sweet spot there. And they will dry beautiful green, and then nice. They will stay beautiful like that. And if you just air dry them or whatever, they don't work so good.
Some kind of oxidation must happen there that, you know, sort of changes the quality of the leaf somehow.
Truly. Now, it may be successful in doing a sun dry, but it seems like when I go out to harvest mamaki, then by the time I get home, it's always after the sun has done its drying power. So
sure.
I like to do it in the dehydrator.
Good reason to have a solar dehydrator near the garden.
Truly.
Now that I think about it.
Indeed, indeed. So in doing this research, I turned, as I often do, to a wonderful resource that I'd like to share with you all.
Yes.
And we do like to feature websites on the show to let folks know some of the valuable resources that we use in our research. And this particular one has been around a number of years, and it is the Flora of the Hawaiian Islands Database. This is a collaborative project of the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History and the National Tropical Botanical Garden, which I'm proud to say is headquartered right here on the island of Kauai. And it has a very long and complicated URL or web address. So rather than giving it to you, I'm just going to recommend that you do a web search for Smithsonian Hawaii. And it's the first result that you'll see, Flora of the Hawaiian Islands Database. I like to then go and hit the checklist page. There's a link there for checklist, and then bookmark that page, because there is an intro page that you'll initially get to. But if you bookmark that checklist page, you'll be able to use the search function straight away. And you can search by major group, so that would be ferns, gymnosperms, or flowering plants. You can search by the family, the genus, the species, the common name, status, whether it's endemic, indigenous, naturalized, and the islands of occurrence. So if you wanted to know all of the native ferns that existed on Kauai and Maui, you could check all those things and you'd get the search result would narrow down to that, which is pretty cool. It also helps you to evaluate if a plant is invasive. So this not only includes the native plants of Hawaii, but all the plants that have naturalized or established populations that readily reproduce themselves without the aids of humans cultivating them. So now every plant that has naturalized is not considered an invasive plant, but it can at least be one of the factors by which you can see if you were interested in growing something. And for instance, you couldn't see that it had been ever cultivated in Hawaii, but perhaps a co-generic plant or a plant in the same genus had been cultivated, then you could maybe infer, if that was a serious weed, upon more research, that you might want to hold off on cultivating one of its co-generic members.
Well, what an undertaking to catalog all of the plants growing in Hawaii.
Well,
it's impressive.
It's got to be an ongoing effort.
Of course.
And thanks so much to Professor Warren Wagner, who sits on, he's a researcher at the Smithsonian Institute, but he also does some work here at the National Tropical Botanical Gardens. One of the co-authors of the Manual of Flowering Plants of the Hawaiian Islands, a super guy, and he's advanced the understanding of the Hawaiian flora so much. And I'm proud to say that I actually have some photographs that are featured on the Smithsonian website too.
Cool.
Of some of the native plants that I've encountered in the forest. No mamaki, but some relatives of. So yeah. Oh, and one more thing to say on mamaki is that when I was first introduced to it was on the Nepali coast by some folks who were drinking it, but it turned out that it wasn't mamaki. It's a plant that looks very much like mamaki, but it's called Akolea, and the botanical name is Bomeria grandis. The way you can tell, the easiest way to tell the difference between the two is that Akolea has a flower stalk that it's kind of like a spray of flowers on a spear that extends beyond the plant, whereas mamaki flowers along the stem of the plant and is a bush, is a tree, whereas Akolea is more of a real shrubby bush that grows right by the water's edge, but also makes a fantastic tea.
Cool.
Yeah. So this is In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio with your hosts Paul and Robin. And right now, we are really excited to speak with our special guest today, Dr. Hector Valenzuela. Hector is a professor and crop specialist at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resources. He has graduate degrees in crop production from the University of Florida and Washington State University. Hector, among other things, is a collaborator in the Hawaii Public Seed Initiative. He did a lot of research at the initiation of that group that we started back in 2009, 2010, and we're really excited. He's going to be designing our lettuce variety trial that we'll be conducting on Kauai this spring. And Hector's going to join us in a discussion on solving pest problems for onions. This is In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts, Paul and Robin. Right now, we're really excited to be joined by our special guest on the phone, Dr. Hector Valenzuela.
Could you take that again from the top?
Sure will. This is In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio with your hosts, Paul and Robin. Right now, we're really excited to be joined on the phone by our special guest, Dr. Hector Valenzuela. Hector's originally from Guatemala, and he's been a vegetable crop specialist at the University of Hawaii for about 20 years and has graduate degrees from Washington State and University of Florida. His area of research has been in crop production and agroecology, researching alternative management practices based on ecological principles to manage pests and to promote nutrient cycles in the farm. He's worked on germplasm selection, which consists of identifying varieties adapted to Hawaii, and has more recently joined efforts to help develop a public seed initiative in the state. And we're really excited Hector's going to help us develop a lettuce trial for Kauai this spring. Hector, it's great to have you on the show again.
Hey, Paul. Nice talking to you.
Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, we're going to be excited to connect with you on onion production, which we've been doing as a focus for the past few weeks on the show. And as we usually round out, we finish with pest problems, because it seems like once you get that crop in the ground, then that's the next thing that happens, is that those problems crop up. But of course, we want to be ready before they get there.
Yes, and with onions, we do have a lot of pests and diseases that pop up.
Well, Hector, I read the paper that you wrote about bulb onion production in Hawaii, and one of the most fascinating parts of that paper for me was the integrated pest management section. I'd wonder if you could start out talking about that a little bit.
So this is, the publication is more focused for the larger scale commercial production. So to the growers, to the commercial growers, we are promoting to use an integrated pest management. And this consists of, so you have different strategies that you have available. So it's kind of putting them all together to make it more effective. And with IPM, the idea is to use all cultural management, alternative practices, and when everything else fails, you may have to rely on applying a product, a pesticide or some kind of product to control it. But one of the key features is to first understand the biology of the plant, of the pest, and understand the biology, be able to identify it, and then you can make a better decision. This is the weakest link, the easiest way to control the disease for the farmer or for the grower.
Yes, so I noticed as well from your paper that onion thrips was a major pest. You said the major pest in Hawaii.
Yeah, onion thrips is one of the major pests. And one of the things that happens is that, again, we're talking more of the large-scale guys like in Kula, where you grow a few acres of onions, or everybody's growing onions.
Right.
One of the things that we see is that when farmers start to use chemicals or sprays to control insects, that these insects eventually develop resistance to these chemicals. So eventually it kind of backfires on you. And eventually you actually end up developing what is called outbreaks. That means that you kill the beneficial insects, the good guys. Mm. So down the road, you start getting outbreaks of the bad guys. So thrips become like a real problem. And every year, problem becomes worse and worse. And lately, we got a new viral disease on onions, which is transmitted by thrips. And this has just made it even worse.
Mm. What is that called?
This is the iris, like the flower iris, yellow spot virus. Mm-hmm. And it's a relatively new viral disease that has shown up globally. And in Hawaii, came over like the past few years. So it's in Maui. I think it's also in Oahu, in the Waianae area. And I don't know if it's made it to Kauai yet, but this is something to keep an eye on. So one of the key things is that when you see something new on the garden or on the farm, it's always good to take a sample to extension, to UH extension, and they send it to the lab to get a real good identification. Instead of you guessing this or that, you get a definite ID, and this is going to help you down the road for many years.
Right. What sort of crop losses are people looking at from that new virus?
I don't know if it's 30, 40% virus loss, but, I mean, if you get all of you feel infected, you're talking your entire crop. So the commercial guys have it a little harder because they're planting year-round. They have large scale. I think the home gardener has a little easier because we can isolate specific batches of onion, and we don't have all that high level of infestation like the commercial guys do.
Sure, although sometimes in home gardens, our sanitation practices aren't all that they should be. So we really want to look out. Can I just ask you, just so I'm clear, it's the thrips that are carrying this iris yellow spot virus?
Correct. So it's the onion thrips. With onions, we get mostly the onion thrips are the main pest.
And what are the main causes of the onion thrips?
Well, they like to reproduce a lot, and they like it when it's dry and hot. And as you know, over the past few years in Hawaii, it's been drier and drier. So that means it's a lot easier for the thrips just to become happier and happier. And again, we're in a cycle of we're trying to control them with sprays, and the sprays kind of just make them stronger every subsequent year. So normally for viruses, like we have the virus, mosaic virus in corn, they stop planting for a few months, and that kind of stops the reproduction of the inoculum. So if everybody agrees to do that, it's kind of easier to control it. But like you're saying with gardeners, maybe your neighbors are growing onions, and not everybody might agree on stopping to grow onions for a couple of months. Mm-hmm. So more and more pest management is moving towards communities working together to develop these kind of controls.
I saw, too, in the paper, there are so many hosts for that thrip. So even if you stop growing onions, if you're growing beans, broccoli, cabbage, carrots, cauliflower, I mean, then it just keeps going on. Leeks, melons, orchids, those all could be hosting the onion thrip waiting for you to plant your next onion crop, yes?
Right. So, yeah, there's a lot of alternate hosts. So this is something that you have to keep in mind. Look at what are the hosts, what's going around your garden, what kind of weeds are on your garden, and try to not have those around. So yeah, it takes like a concerted effort. And I don't know if you want to grow like borders or windbreaks around your plot to make it harder on the thrips to move on. One of the angles with thrips is that part of their life cycle is in the soil. So from my perspective, that has been an angle that I have taken. You know, with organics, we're also always talking about improving the soil. So my perspective has, can we use mulches? Can we use improved soil organic content? So when the thrips are reproducing in the soil, there's going to be good guys in the soil that say, I'm going to mulch on these thrips. Mm-hmm. So you would break that cycle. Nice. And I don't think we have used that as much conventionally. But on the mainland, we have heard reports that growers that have used mulches see lower levels of thrips.
Would solarization be a good method to kill off the thrips during their soil cycle?
I'm sorry?
Is solarization a method that will control thrips in their soil cycle?
Solarization, yes. And solarization is something that we have looked at because onions also have several soil diseases. So solarization may be a good technique. And so you may get help to reduce some level of diseases and also tackle some of the pest problems. And this would include thrips and also the leaf miners. And leaf miners also have part of their life cycle in the soil as well.
Mm-hmm. So again, talking about integrated pest management, you told us that when we use a product or if we're spraying something directly on the pest, that that's really the last ditch effort, and you try to do all other kinds of cultural controls, which is what we've been discussing so far. If we do have to resort to a spray for these onion thrips, I'm hoping that there are natural solutions and not just chemical ones that could be effective.
There may be natural solutions. I just wanted to go back to the solarization. Sorry, I missed it.
Sure, no.
One thing with solarization is that you need to get the temperature high enough. We have tried it, say, in Kula at high elevation in Maui, and we haven't been able to get the higher temperatures that you need to control some of the diseases.
Yes.
So, again, if you try it in the wintertime, in Kauai, you may not be able to get those high temperatures. So this is something that you have to keep track of.
Right.
Can you tell us, Hector, for our listeners, how they might be able to identify a thrips infestation early on? What are the signs that the plant will be showing you?
I think you can monitor the thrips. So this is you just visiting the farm, visiting the garden, and looking at the inside the leaves and the onion, and you would see the little thrips kind of starting to feed in there. So it is a good idea to, as soon as you put your plants in the garden and everything's going on in the garden, to start inspecting. And not only the onions, but also around other plants around the garden. You can go around the flowers and kind of touch them with your finger, and sometimes the onions are going to drop into your hands. so you can start saying, yeah, I'm starting to get thrips, and what can I do about it? Mm-hmm. And you had asked, Paul had asked earlier about products, and yes, so we may have some products that are out there to control thrips, and these may be more natural type products. But the idea is, how can I develop all the proper cultural practices to try to prevent this problem from even showing up?
Right.
And if this does show up, you would have perhaps some product available. But this is not something that you're going to use, well, I'm just going to spray it 3 times a week. This is something that you would only use sporadically, maybe once or twice during the growing cycle to prevent the an outbreak from exploding.
Right. So I want to let listeners know we're speaking with Dr. Hector Valenzuela on In the Garden on the Farm. We're discussing overcoming pest and disease problems with onion production, and we've given a pretty detailed look at onion thrips and an associated virus that they are now spreading in the onion fields in at least the commercial areas, iris yellow spot virus. Maybe with the few minutes that we have left, you could mention some of the other pest and disease problems that people might face. You mentioned leaf miners, maybe some other ones that people would have a lookout for.
Right. So, yeah, onions, they'll have a good range of diseases. We also have the leaf miners, and you can see the little mines on the leaves. And leaf miners are also a result of too much spraying. Normally, if you just let it go, beneficial organisms are normally going to control leaf miners. There's also a few diseases. One of the big ones for us is pink root disease. It's a fungi that lives in the soil. And we really haven't been able to find a resistant variety, but we have found varieties that are so vigorous that they can outgrow the disease. We have other soil borne diseases like Fusarium. We also have a bacterial disease that is Erwinia. These take place when there's more humid type of conditions, down in mildew as well. So again, our perspective is, how can I create more of better drainage or the drier environment so that we don't have all that moisture accumulating in the soil? And if we do get the disease, how can we start rotating or not planting the same onion in the same plot, in the same site, crop after crop?
So would you be willing to clue us in to some of the best varieties that you've been able to trial?
Yes. We have looked at a lot of varieties over the past few years, but they have been more for the commercial growers, and these are Granex-type varieties. And normally the varieties used by growers are a little different than the ones used by home gardeners. But yeah, I'll be happy to share what we have.
And it's the case that the University of Hawaii has developed its own varieties over time. Are those still viable based on the pest and disease matrix that's currently represented here?
We have some older varieties. And even though they are shorter day by lot varieties, they're a little more pungent. But we haven't really kept up with the selection and breeding. So I don't know how well do they meet current standards in terms of quality and taste and what we're looking for. But this is part of the public seed initiative that we're working on, Paul. And this is because we're like in ground zero. We can start to select varieties, select crop, making our own crosses and developing our own varieties that are adapted to our specific growing conditions around the islands. So this is like a huge opportunity for Hawaii, for young kids to get into it and say, hey, I'm going to start to develop new onion varieties and select them and identifying which are the best ones for each of our locations.
Well, you know, we're really excited about that, both Robin and I, about in some way contributing to crop development, and excited to get started with you on the lettuce trial. Maybe you could let our listeners know just a little bit about the kind of trial you're going to design for us.
We're talking about doing a lettuce trial, and it's always good to have it in different locations because each location is unique. So we would select about four or five varieties on each farm. And if there's space available, we would have some level of replication. That means on each farm, we would grow three copies of the same variety at different sites within this individual garden or farm. And each farm is kind of unique in terms of moisture, how cold it is, the type of the soil. So at the end of the trial, you can get a lot of real valuable information of, yeah, we identified this variety that does really well among a range of locations. So we can continue to work with this variety that is real strong, has a real strong root system, and we don't need a lot of products to protect it from pests. So we can use it to continue to grow it, or to use it as a parent to make another cross and develop varieties for the future.
Well, that sounds totally fascinating, and it sounds like there's going to be a lot of lettuce to sample after all these trials go, because taste is one of the most important qualities that we'd be looking for, yeah?
Yeah, we're going to need a lot of volunteers to help us taste these varieties.
I bet, Hector, if people are interested in taking part in the trial, is there a contact information where they might be able to link into that?
So basically, the more locations we have, the most useful. And you don't have to have a big farm, only if you have a garden and willing to do it. So you can contact, I guess, Regenerations with Paul. You can contact myself at hector@hawaii.edu. And if you want to join in, you're more than welcome, regardless of where you're at.
Great. And I know we're looking to put this together in the next month. So folks who are interested in participating in that lettuce trial know that that's the time frame to be in touch with us if you're interested to get involved. Dr. Valenzuela, it's great to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us and taking time out of your busy schedule to share about your research and the work that's upcoming. And we're really grateful that you're doing this work in our beautiful Hawaii islands.
Thanks, Paul and Robin, and good luck to all the gardeners out there.
All right. Mahalo. Talk to you soon.
Mahalo.
Okay, what a great conversation with Hector. We are so blessed to have researchers like him here. We are going to move on to Secrets of the Soil Builders right now, and we're going to talk about pH and nutrient availability.
Yes, indeed. So it turns out that the pH of our soil is, they call it sort of a master factor in terms of whether or not you're going to get good crop growth or good plant growth. And we're going to have a little look at why that's the case. Robin and I are kind of wrapping our heads around it. We think we understand it, and so we're going to share our understanding. I'll start off just by saying that the pH range goes from 0 to 14, and 7 is considered a neutral soil. And we find that a good soil pH is sort of ideally between 6.5 to 7, or 6 to 7 is acceptable for many crops. And pH can be defined as the measurement of the concentration of hydrogen ions in soil water. This information from the University of Hawaii's great website on crop production. The greater the concentration of hydrogen ions in the soil water solution, the lower the pH. And it turns out that an acidic soil actually makes macronutrients, quite a few of them, harder for plants to get a hold of. And that would include nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur, calcium, magnesium, sodium, and molybdenum. All of these macro and micronutrients made harder to access for plants when you've got a low pH. So that would be a reason for increasing, liming the soil, or increasing the pH.
And as it turns out, micronutrients tend to be less available in soils with a high pH. And those include boron, copper, iron, chloride, manganese, and zinc. So there is that sweet spot where we want our pH of our soil. So how do we know what the pH of our own soils is? That's a really good question. One way to access that information would be to get a soil test. A soil test is available from the University of Hawaii at our Extension Service offices, ours here in Lihue. And there are also private laboratories on the internet that will do soil tests for you. The bonus about springing for the soil test is that you actually find out not just the pH, but where the nutrient levels are in your soil, which will help you to refine what you might want to add to the soils. Another option is home use pH meters, and there are quite a number of those available in pretty much any price range. We've all had some hits and misses with those meters. HANA instruments are kind of the most famous ones of all, and they do range from all different kinds of readings that you can get out of them. There are just simple pH meters as well. But a word if you're searching for those is a lot of the meters are made to take the pH of a solution and not of actual soil material. So you want to really research it. And if you're going to kick down for an expensive piece of equipment like that, you might want to for sure know what it's used for exactly. And certainly in our experience, it seems like you get what you pay for as far as the meters go. Less expensive ones can be less accurate, which sort of defeats the purpose altogether. So pH is also related to the cation exchange capacity, which ultimately is basically the charge of the soil. It's a measure of fertility. It is an indicator of the nutrient retention capacity in our soil, so how it's going to leach out or go into our plants, one or the other. And in our research, what we understand, please correct us if we're incorrect on this, but it looks like when the pH goes down, the CEC also goes down. And when the pH goes up, the CEC also goes up. And so there is, again, that sweet spot where the plants are, where the charge of the soil is high, and it's basically showing you that there's a lot of life and a lot of action happening in your soil, which is pretty much what you like.
Truly. And here in Hawaii, because of the inherent quality of a lot of our heavy clay soils, it takes a lot more nutrients and liming to actually achieve that correct balance, which can make farming on some of our highly eroded soils a very expensive proposition. One way to correct that is to improve the organic matter composition of the soil. So growing cover crops, adding compost, and adding all manners of organic matter to the soil is going to help to achieve the desired results. So don't forget about the compost. So this is In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. We've got time for just a few announcements before we say so long until next week.
Great. And I'll start with the Kauai Permaculture Design Course. Starting on February 22nd, continuing through March 9th, it will be held in Moloa'a. It's a 2-week permaculture design intensive. It includes camping, meals, instructional materials, and participants completing the course will receive a permaculture design certificate. For more information about the course, visit permaculturekauai.com. Then we also want to announce, very excitingly, the Advanced Techniques to Improve Organic Crop Production on Kauai. That course will be held on Tuesday, March 4th, 2014, from 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., a full day. It'll be at the Waipa Foundation in Honolulu, and the emphasis will be on low-cost, proven techniques that will empower the grower to increase productivity and quality while minimizing the purchase of inputs of all types. Lucky for us, amigo Bob Cantisano, founder of Peaceful Valley Farm Supply, Ecological Farming Association, and many other organizations will be the instructor. He's a well-known expert. This is a really great opportunity. If you would like to register or for more information, organamigo@gmail.com. So that's O-R-G-A-M-I-G-O@gmail.com. Or for more information, call 530-913-5515. We also want to tell you about the Go Farm Hawaii at KCC continuing course, Ag Exposure, from February 22nd to March 29th, Saturday or Sunday to be announced. There'll be farm tours and hands-on learning experience on sustainable farms. For more information, www.gofarmhawaii.org or call 245-8318 to register.
You are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K284AL Haleiwa. This has been In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts Paul and Robin. We'd like to thank our guest on the show today, Dr. Hector Valenzuela. To be in touch with Hector, you can email him at hector@hawaii.edu. Please tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life.
Aloha.